Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, a very warm welcome to RNIB Tech Talk, your regular source of accessible technology news, reviews and interviews from a blindness and partially sighted perspective. I'm Dave Williams. And as always, we're really keen to hear from you here at Tech Talk. You can get in touch by email. Drop us a line to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Joining me, Dave Williams, are our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman. A very warm welcome to you, sir.
Hello, how's it going?
Yeah, really well. Thank you very much. Good to have you with us. And Tasneem Arshad. Hello, Tasneem.
Hello, and it's good to be here.
Coming up this time on RNIB Tech Talk, we'll be hearing from Colin Shales, one of the newest members of our Technology for Life team. We've got a discussion about security in the home, and we'll be checking in with your email. That's all coming up this time on RNIB Tech Talk. Over recent months, we've all become increasingly concerned about the cost of our energy. The prices just seem to be going up and up and up. As blind and partially sighted people, we of course need accessible ways of keeping track of those costs. And one way in which we might do that is with an accessible in-home display that you can request from your energy supplier. With a demonstration now of an accessible energy meter, it's Callum Stoneman.
What I've got in front of me here is the talking in-home display for your smart meter. So the smart meter is in two parts, basically. You have the meter itself, and that replaces your existing gas and electricity meters, which are wherever they may be, usually tucked away in a cupboard somewhere or possibly even outside. So they replace those and they will monitor your usage and give readings just like a traditional meter. But what makes them smart is that they will send readings to your supplier automatically. So you don't have to worry about trying to get meter readings yourself or letting someone in to come and read your meter. The fun bit for us, though, the bit that we're interested in, is the in-home display. So everyone who has a smart meter gets one of these, and this connects wirelessly to the meter and shows you in real time, in pounds and pence, how much energy you're currently using. And you can see your usage in real time, you can see your usage for the whole day, and then you can even go back and review previous usage as well. It goes back up to 12 months, so you can view your last 12 months of usage. And that just gives you a really good, easy way of working out what devices in the home are using energy and where could you be cutting back, whether that be turning off lights, turning things out of standby, unplugging things when they're not needed, turning the heating down a couple of degrees, all that kind of thing. It doesn't go as specific as that. It doesn't say, you know, your TV is costing you 10 pence an hour, but you can, you know, turn things on and see it change. It does update very quickly, which I'll come on to in a minute, but you can turn things on and off and watch it, you know, change and work out that way what's using your energy. So the display itself is not very big at all. It will easily fit onto a worktop or a shelf somewhere. With the screen facing towards me, I'm going to start from the very top of the device. So going across the top, you've got three medium-sized horizontal lines going across the top. And these are lights. So top left is the green light. That indicates low usage. The top middle is the amber light, and that indicates medium usage, and that's also the speak button, so I'll come on to that in a second. And then top right is the red light, and that indicates high usage. All of those relate to electricity usage. So the middle button, I mentioned that's the speak button, and that you can toggle the speech on and off by pressing and holding that button. And when the speech is on, if you press that button once, depending on what's going on, it will either speak the current screen that you're on, or if it's currently talking, that will shut the speech up. So you could think of that as like the two-finger double tap on an iPhone or the control key on a computer. On the front face of the device, if you like, there is a small screen. And on either side of the screen, there is a row of three buttons going down. So the top left is the home button, the middle left is the back button, and the bottom left is the left arrow. And then there's a screen in between them. And then top right is the menu button. Middle right is the OK button. and bottom right is the right arrow key. And obviously they are used to, the main menu button will take you into the device's menu. Use the arrow keys to scroll, the OK button to make your selections. The back button obviously will take you back one level. And the home button, you can think of that as like the home button on an iPhone. So that just takes you back to the main front screen of the device, which is your current energy usage right now. On the back of the device, there is a speaker on the back right, and that's where the speech comes out of. On the middle of the back, it's got its own little stand built in, which is kind of nice, so it stands up a little bit. And then on the back left, there is a micro USB port, which is the power port. This does have a little rechargeable battery that will last about 4 hours. So you could wander around your house, maybe when you first get this and you want to see what the big things are that are using energy. You could unplug it and have a wander around, turn things on and off and see your usage change and get to grips with it that way. Overall, though, it is recommended that you keep this plugged in. So the battery doesn't last very long. It's not really designed to be constantly taken around with you, but you can use that if you want to. So let's see what this sounds like. So the speech is turned off at the minute. So I'm going to press and hold the top middle button, the one that's also the amber light. The device refers to this as the top button, so that's why I'm going to refer to it as well. So we should at the minute be on the home screen of the device, and the first page is the Energy Now page. So I'm going to press and hold that top button, and then it should tell me my current energy usage.
Speech has been turned on. Home. 2 items. 1. Energy Now. Electricity usage is low. Green. Current hourly rate of 3 pence. There has been no gas used recently. Press the OK button to change to kilowatts.
Okay, there you go. So we're currently using 3 pence an hour of electricity. That's kind of about average for us. I know from using this previously, we tend to be at about 3, 4, maybe 5 pence when there's not really much going on. There's just the essentials turned on. You can also have that in watts and kilowatts, as it said as well. So I'll just press OK to show you that.
Electricity usage is low. Green. Current rate of 118 watts. There has been no gas used recently. Press the OK button to change to pounds.
I don't understand the watts measurement personally. I prefer to have good old pounds and pence, so I'll just press OK to change it back.
Electricity usage is low. Green.
And then I'll just press the top button to shut it up. So that's the usage right now. You'll notice that electricity usage was low, green, current rate of 3 pence. Gas usage, it just says there's been no gas used recently. Electricity updates in real time. Gas just seems to send an update periodically. I think it's every 30 minutes. So it will give you a recent gas usage based on what's been used in that 30-minute period or whatever the period is that it sends an update. I don't know if that's unique to me and my supplier or if that's a general thing, how it works in general, but that's why the gas is read out slightly differently. The electricity is real time and that updates very, very quickly. In fact, I've got a little clip here. Here's something I recorded earlier. A little clip here to show you how quick it updates. So I'm now in my kitchen and there's not much going on at the minute, so the electricity usage should be quite low. I'll just press the top button.
Home. 2 items. 1. Energy Now. Electricity usage is low. Green. Current hourly rate of 3 pence.
Yeah.
There has been no gas used recently. Press the OK button to change to kilowatts.
Okay, so if I now turn on the kettle. I'm just going to make myself a cup of tea, so I'll put the kettle on. Okay, and that's starting up, so you should be able to hear that boiling now. Now, if I press the top button again, we should hear quite a big change in the energy usage, or the electricity usage at least, so let's see what that is.
Home. 2 items. 1. Energy Now. Electricity usage is medium. Amber. Current hourly rate of 93 pence. There has been no gas used recently. Press the OK button to change to kilowatts.
There you go. So you heard how quick it updated there. Also, the one cup kettle's a bit of an energy burner, isn't it? Glad that's only on for a few seconds at a time. So that's how quick it updates. So that's the first page of your home screen. If I press the right arrow, we'll go to the next page of the home screen, which is
Energy Today. Total electricity used today, £1.17. Budget has not been set. Total gas used today, 85 pence. Budget has not been set. Press the OK button to change to kilowatts.
There you go. So that gives you an overall usage for the current day. So that's since midnight. And what I've found is, for some reason, When this is left on the Energy Now tab, it seems to keep speaking every 2 minutes or so, even if there's been no change. So I don't really know why that is. So because of that, I prefer to have it on the Energy Today tab permanently. That seems to cause it to stay quiet. Or you could just turn the speech off and put the speech back on when you want to hear your usage. And it does reference, you may have noticed, it does reference the lights at the top as well. So when it says electricity usage is low, green, that means that the green light is actually lit up visually as well. So as well as that usage being displayed on the screen, it's also telling you what the lights are doing, which I think is, you know, really nice. And obviously you heard then it changed when the kettle was on, you heard it say medium amber. Then what you can also do is look at your usage as well. So I'm going to press the menu button, which is the top right.
Main menu, 7 items, 1, usage history. Press the next or previous buttons to move between items, then press the OK button to select.
So we've got usage history, and then if we press OK.
Usage history, 2 items, 1, electricity. Press the next or previous buttons to move between items, then press the OK button to select.
Okay, so let's see what we've got here. We've got electricity, if we press the next button, which is the bottom right.
2, gas, bottom of menu reach.
Oh, your gas, so you can view your gas usage there as well. So I'm going to go back to electric, so I press the previous button, bottom left.
1, electricity, top of menu reach.
So I'm going to press OK, which is the middle right. But before I do this, you've got four options in there. You've got hourly, daily, weekly, and monthly. But it straight away starts reading out a summary. So the first thing it's going to start reading is hourly usage, and then it will start straight away reading the hourly usage from 12 a.m. So let's have a listen.
Electricity usage history. 4 items. 1. Hours. Total today is £1.17. This includes a daily standing charge of 47.9 pence. Press the OK button to change to kilowatts. A summary now follows. Press the top button to stop. The highest cost was 9 pence during the hour of 7 a.m. Midnight. 5 pence. 1 a.m. 5 pence. 2 a.m. 4 pence. 3 a.m. 5 pence. 4 a.m.
I'm just going to press the top button to shut it up. So that's it reading out the usage. Now, this is one thing that I don't like about it, is that you cannot scroll through this. If I press the next button.
2 days. Total today is £1.17. Press the OK button to change to kilowatts. A summary now follows. Press the top button to stop. The highest cost was £3.09 during last Thursday. Last Wednesday, £1.79. Last Thursday,
etc. So that for me is a bit of an annoyance. I'd like to be able to, you know, scroll through, because let's say, for example, we're in May now as I record this. Let's say you wanted to look at your monthly usage and you wanted to know what you'd used in March, for example. It will start from 12 months prior. So you'd have to sit through 10 months worth before you get to March, before you get to the one you want. So, you know, my personal wish list, I'd like it to be a bit more, you know, I'd like it to be easier to kind of scroll through things, or even if you could speed up the voice. I'm not going to go through the settings here, but in terms of speech settings, there's not really much. You've just got speech on and off. Volume, you've got three options there. You've got low, medium, and high. It's set to low at the minute, which I still think is pretty loud. And then you've got a section as well where does it repeat alerts? Does it say alerts every 5 minutes until you dismiss them, or does it just read alerts once? You can change that setting there. And that is basically alerts of, if you've got a budget set, then it would alert you when you hit your budget or exceed your budget. And these are soft budgets, just to be clear. So you can set a budget on this, a daily, weekly, or a monthly budget, and that's just for guidance. So if you, for example, go over your budget, it's not going to turn off your supply. But if you set a budget of, let's say, I don't know, £50 a month on electricity, and 1 month you went to £55, it's not going to turn anything off. Everything's still going to work as normal. It's just that when you're reviewing your usage, it will say your usage this month was this much, you went £5 over budget or 10% over budget, whatever. So that's how that works. And then we should still be in usage at the minute. So to get out of this, I mentioned the home button on the top left being like the home button on your iPhone. If I press this, it should just take us straight out back to the Energy Now page.
Home. Two items. Two. Energy Today.
Okay.
Total
Browse back to Energy Today, but still. So that is just a quick overview of the talking in-home display. Definitely worth asking your supplier about. If you're, you know, looking at getting a smart meter, ask your supplier about the accessible version of the in-home display. Yeah, there's a few glitches with it. There's a few things that I'd like to be different, but it's still a very accessible way of keeping track of your energy usage. And we get the same information as sighted people, which is fantastic.
Callum Stoneman with your review of the accessible smart meter. Callum, how do we get hold of an accessible smart meter? I mean, these things aren't littering the street like confetti, are they?
Sadly not, no. I mean, in theory, it should be easy. You know, when you speak to your supplier about having a smart meter installed, if you just say to them, you know, you're blind and you want the talking in-home display, they should know what you mean. My supplier, I got it no problem from my supplier. In fact, I didn't even ask for it. The engineer knew from my record that I was visually impaired and they brought it around for me. And the engineer himself was quite fascinated, actually, because he'd never seen these or set one up. So he set it all up for me and showed me how to use it. And he was loving using it as well, actually. He found it really good. But from what I've heard, I think some suppliers are not really aware of it. You know, maybe the customer service team aren't aware of it. I think most suppliers should be able to supply these nowadays. They've been around for a few years, but there's just a lack of awareness, so you may just have to kind of push them a little bit. If they've got an accessibility team or a priority services team, they might be a good, you know, a good one to get in touch with if they can put you through to those. But yeah, unfortunately, the awareness of these things isn't perhaps as good as we'd like, but most major suppliers should be able to supply you with them.
Yeah, and I know this is something that RNIB has worked on to try and raise awareness, and there is information on the RNIB website about these accessible in-home displays, but it's really important to hammer home that point, isn't it, about being persistent, because sometimes the energy supplier may well outsource the installation of your smart meter to a third-party company. You know, I've been on this journey where initially my energy supplier, they didn't have a clue what I was talking about, you know, and I had to kind of keep trying and keep asking and just be gently persistent, saying, look, you know, if you install a regular smart meter, I'm not going to be able to read it, you know, because myself and my wife, we're both blind. So we really do need the talking one. And eventually that's what's happening. So yeah, massively important to be persistent on there. And I mean, we should say as well, it's been quite a journey to get to this point, because I know the first generation of smart meters, they were tied to a single supplier and you couldn't change suppliers. That's no longer the case.
Yes, exactly. So nowadays, all of the smart meters, I think they're known as second generation smart meters, and they are not tied to any specific supplier. So you could say you're with British Gas at the minute and then you decide to switch to somebody else. You can keep your smart meter, you can keep your existing in-home display. You don't have to mess about getting a new one from them. You know, once you've got your smart meter installed and your accessible in-home display, you're good to go then. It doesn't matter if you decide to switch or you decide to stay with the same supplier for years, you can just keep that how it is, which is really good.
That's fantastic. Well, if you find any other accessible ways in which we as blind and partially sighted people can keep track of our energy usage, we'd be really glad to hear about it here on RNIB Tech Talk. Callum Stoneman, thank you very much. Regular listeners to RNIB Tech Talk will know that the Technology for Life team from RNIB is just a phone call or email away, a team of experts ready, willing and able to answer your technology-related questions. But what's it like from the other side? Well, we catch up with Colin Shales now, who is one of the newest members of RNIB's Technology for Life team. Now, as you know, RNIB's Technology for Life team provides a comprehensive service for blind and partially sighted people across the UK who need help with technology. You can get in touch via email or over the phone. And one of the people that you might be connecting with when you do reach out to RNIB's Technology for Life team is our West Midlands coordinator, Mr. Colin Shales. Hello, Colin. Welcome to Tech Talk.
Hello, Dave. Thank you very much for having me on.
You're very welcome. Now, you love technology and you've worked in technology for quite some time. So your interest in technology then came from your father, who was interested in electronics and computer science and building computers, essentially.
Yes, that's correct. He was always into dabbling with machines, always got his head in something and, tinkering and playing with devices. And that's where my kind of interest for doing the same came from. Even when I had a good level of sight, I'd just be playing around with anything that was electronic, throughout the 80s and 90s. And then in 1994, when I was diagnosed with Stargardt's disease, a form of macular degeneration, there was an actual need for some technology, and it started off fairly low tech to begin with, things like low vision aids, magnifiers. But my first kind of real piece of tech that I was given to help me with my visual impairment was one of the old Star Writers, which was like a printer with a screen built in and a keyboard all in one. And I could do my work on that. And then eventually upgraded to laptops and various other electronic devices. And it kind of went from there. Always wanted to kind of have the all-in-one solution. And then, many years later, things like the iPhone came out and talks on the old Nokia devices. And I just wanted that kind of all-in-one pocket solution. And I'd just tinker around with that and play with that. And my world of accessibility just opened up dramatically around about the time I was at university in the early noughties. And I was able to, complete my education with the help of technology. And of course, that went on from there to the start of my career in technology, which was at Dolphin Computer Access, where I was a software test analyst for best part of a decade until fairly recently, where I would actually test the Supernova product and other Dolphin products for kind of usability and accessibility. And making sure it's suitable for the market. Obviously my personal interest kept going on. And what I really wanted to do recently was expand on that and actually support people with visual impairments in all areas of technology. And to further that kind of journey, I decided to apply for the role of the Technology for Life coordinator in the West Midlands, which is where I'm at now, 4 months in, and making very good headways with that.
I'll be really interested to hear about that, how getting started and hearing what people ask you in that role as the West Midlands coordinator for the Technology for Life team. But going back to the kind of building computers, did you ever do that yourself? Was that something you were interested in doing, actually assembling your own computer?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a bit easier when I had more sight in the past, and PC systems were a little bit easier in my opinion to put together with the components. And it all started from the old 386, the IBM 386, and kind of worked up from there. But yes, I used to put the systems together myself and install Windows or DOS. It was originally DOS Shell 6, I believe I started on, and then kind of up from there to Windows. I do all of that. And it's that actually that I don't tend to do very much nowadays, just because it is kind of get your head in, and you do require some sighted assistance to be able to put components together, I find. Used to get very hands-on with technology.
It sort of begs the question, why? I mean, you can buy a perfectly good, ready-built, computer off the shelf. Was it curiosity? Did you think you could do a better job than the big guys? Were you very particular about the components that you wanted to build with? What was your motivation? Was it cheaper?
It was a lot cheaper, Dave. And to be honest, you may remember back in the 90s, there wasn't really any of these PC retailers available to you, or very few, until kind of the millennium. But what used to take occur was computer fairs, you know, on weekends all over the country. And enthusiasts would go to these and pick up components fairly cheap, sometimes new components directly from the manufacturer or second-hand parts. And it was just the fun of it. It was the ability to build a machine for a fraction of the price, put it together and say that you've done it yourself and set it up the way you want. And to be honest, to the specification that you wanted as well. And you could do kinds of all sorts of things that a manufacturer wouldn't have set up for you initially. But it was just that home brew kind of computer thing that went on in the 90s that really, where this kind of interest for technology stemmed from.
Right. And products like the Raspberry Pi have tried to bring that back a little bit. There was a feeling a few years back, I think, that, you know, somehow we'd lost something with products that are sealed, where the manufacturer discourages you from kind of opening up the case or changing out components. You know, I just had my smartwatch sent away to get a new battery. It's been away a week. It cost me a fortune. You know, swapping out a battery, it really shouldn't be that hard, really. But it is. And so obviously we've got things now like the Raspberry Pi, and if you get the right version of Raspbian or whatever on there, you can put a screen reader on the Raspberry Pi. Are you getting that vibe that people less and less are building their own equipment, and perhaps we've lost something there, or do you think it's alive and well?
To be honest, Dave, first of all, going back to what you say about mainstream technology and how difficult it is to actually get components replaced, you're absolutely right. And as manufacturers want to kind of close off that kind of personal dabbling experience of changing batteries and things, as technology gets smaller and they want to kind of control the experience and make sure that you don't put in substandard parts and the repercussions go back onto the manufacturer. So I can understand why they do close off things like swapping out batteries and the way that how small devices are and they're laminated together and things like that. And you're right, it did take away some of the experience of being able to do this. And with the Raspberry Pi, it's not something I've personally been dabbling with. Maybe one day I will do. But yeah, I think there is still, it's a bit like vinyl record. There is still, a following out there. I tend to find it's a lot of the younger kids that are dabbling in putting their computers together. They may buy a system that's kind of partially built, or they order their components, but a lot of them do like to put together their systems, especially for gaming, for high spec systems, and they like to set it exactly the way they are. And there's lots of communities, online communities and forums on how to do this. And I think it is alive. It is alive. Maybe not to the extent it was back in the day, but yes, I do.
It does require a lot of research and perseverance, yeah, and determination. I have literally run out of patience when it comes to assembling, you know, my own stuff. I used to be all into that, you know, but faffing around with jumpers and making sure that the right hard disk was set to master and all that kind of stuff. Oh, my days. Yeah, yeah. It made me go great. We'll be hearing more from Colin Shales a little bit later on. Still to come on RNIB Tech Talk, we'll be discussing home security and catching up with your email. I remember a few years ago being asked as a blind person whether, when I went home, did I bother switching on my lights? Well, I do have some light perception, so I do. How about you, Callum Stoneman? Do you switch your lights on when you're at home?
Yeah, I do, because I've got a sighted wife, but I didn't used to, and I've done it before where I've come home from school years ago or from work or whatever, come in, and I've been the only one in the house, not switched the lights on, and frighten the life out of the next sighted person that's come in, and I'm just there in the dark.
So let's talk about security, because clearly, if you switch a light on, then that lets everybody know there's somebody around, yeah, and it perhaps goes some way to mitigating the risk of people thinking that the property is standing empty. So perhaps there are, you know, good security reasons why even totally blind people who perhaps don't benefit from lighting would still go ahead and switch lights on.
Yeah, absolutely. And now my wife works away a lot, but I'm very conscious now of, you know, when she's away and I'm the only person in the house. Yeah, strictly speaking, I don't need the lights on, but I put them on anyway because, well, one, I feel like it's probably nice for the pets to have some light. But yeah, from a security point of view as well, and we've got smart lights and they help a lot with that because you can easily check on an app whether the lights are turned on or turned off, and you can set certain times. So, you know, you could set them to come on at sunset or turn off at sunrise or whatever.
Yeah, and you can of course use the smart speakers now as well. Your A-Lady to control the lighting with your voice as well. Sometimes in the evening we'll do that, you know, and yeah. I've put my ceiling lights in a group, so I say to the A-Lady, turn on the big light, and on they come.
There's a classic northern thing there. Put big light on.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. So what else can we do to use technology in an accessible way to make our homes secure, Callum?
I think in some ways, as daft as it sounds for blind people, I think cameras are a good way to go. I mean, we've got the Ring doorbell in our house, which I love from a security point of view. We didn't even buy it for an accessibility point of view, really. We bought it just as a general product because of the convenience of, you know, it's an easy method of CCTV outside the house. It's all wireless, so you don't have to mess about running wires and having a little recording box somewhere and running all the cameras to it like you used to in the good old days of CCTV. But we bought it for the convenience of that, and then being able to answer the door from when we're out of the house and be able to say, oh, can you just leave that package next door, or, you know, oh, sorry, we're not in at the minute. But I really like it from my point of view that, well, one, if someone comes to the door late at night, I can answer the door and check who it is without actually opening the door and putting myself at that risk. But it's reassuring for me to know that we don't like thinking about this, but if a burglary or some sort of crime does happen, you know, the house gets broken into or the car gets broken into, then there's no way that I would be able to provide the police any kind of description or anything to go off. You know, and I think that'd be the case for a lot of blind or partially sighted people. So it's reassuring for me to know that the footage is there, so that even though I can provide them absolutely nothing to go off from what I've seen, I can still pull up the footage from the Ring doorbell, which should have picked something up, and send them that video and say, you know, okay, this is what my security system's picked up.
Would you like to record a demo for us, Callum?
Yeah, why not? I need to stop talking about all these products. I'm just giving myself more work here.
Yeah, well, I look forward to hearing that. But, you know, we should say that prevention is better than cure. And even if you're partially sighted, just having a simple, you know, motion sensor outside so the lighting comes on when you get near to your door, that can be helpful. Maybe having a smart speaker on a schedule so maybe there's some music comes on at certain times of day. There's lots of ways in which you can create the illusion that somebody is around if you're not going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, with anything in security wise, you will never be 100% secure. And that's just an unfortunate thing. But if we can have as many measures in place and as many things to assist us in place as possible, then, as you said, it gives us the best chance of either preventing it or recovering from it, if you like, if something does happen.
Well, we should look forward to that Ring doorbell demonstration next week, hopefully. Callum, thanks very much. So you know the problem. You settle down to listen to an audiobook, and you find yourself drifting off. And then the next time you come to pick up your book, who knows where you rewind to? Well, one person who's tackled this problem joins us now.
I'm Gary McDowell, based in Belfast, and I'm a chartered surveyor. The problem that I addressed was falling asleep listening to audiobooks and podcasts. With my work, I was travelling extensively throughout Ireland. We had a number of big projects in Limerick, which necessitated me travelling for 4 hours by train to get there and 4 hours back again. So I started listening to audiobooks, but unfortunately I kept falling asleep, and rather frustratingly, I couldn't find my place where I'd fallen asleep in the story. And as a consequence, I stopped downloading audiobooks. And since then, I found that this is a major problem for the majority of people who listen to audio. I happened to be talking to a colleague regarding the problem, and I said, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was an app that would address this? And he said, I know someone who could do that for you. So very quickly, from just having the idea or recognizing the problem, I found myself involved in actually developing an app to address the issue. The development took an awful lot longer than I had hoped, because it's a new industry. It's an industry that I wasn't experienced in. And the app developer that I originally got involved in, who were very, very good and very attentive and very quick in terms of dealing with the issues, they got bought over by another company, and then the development of the app stalled. So it sat on the shelf, partially developed. Now, we did have a working prototype, but it sat there, I'd say, for over a year, until I heard an advert on the radio for Raise Ventures in Belfast, who were looking for startup businesses to work with. And I contacted Raise, and they took me onto their accelerator program. And I got back, with their assistance, involved with a developer. And we were able to bring the app to launch just 2 weeks ago.
So, Gary, can you tell us a bit about how the app works then? What would somebody need to do to benefit from the app?
It's very, very simple to use. When you download the app, it downloads onto the iPhone. At the moment, we only have an iOS version, but we will bring out an Android version in due course. But you download it on the phone. It also automatically loads onto your Apple Watch. And once you have it downloaded on the phone, you don't need to access the app on your phone again. Everything happens from the watch. You can activate it by voice control, or you can press the little icon on the watch face, open the app, and you're presented with a button. And the button, quite simply, is start. Now, once you start it, it then does everything else automatically. Through the health data, it calculates the point at which it believes that you are falling asleep. And when it detects that, it will give you a tap through the haptic in the watch, and it will also send you a written message again on the watch face. Now, if you don't dismiss it, if you are falling asleep, it will automatically pause the playback, and you can then restart from where you fell asleep. It solves the problem, as I say, of not losing your place. If you do dismiss it, if you feel that you're not falling asleep, and whenever we've been testing this, we have always found that it has been pretty accurate, in that I certainly have always been falling asleep. And if I dismiss it, I have found that that it then continues on and I fall asleep and it doesn't pause, because what it does is it resets or recalibrates the point at which it believes that you're falling asleep. So, as I say, we have found that it is very accurate, very reliable. If you don't dismiss it, it will simply pause the playback, and it works very efficiently.
So you mentioned that audiobooks, that was where you kind of started this journey, falling asleep while listening to audiobooks. And, you know, I quite often mention that when I'm talking about Braille, because I always think that listening to audio, you know, can be, you know, a fairly passive experience. And there's nothing more soporific, is there, than, you know, somebody like Stephen Fry reading to you, and before you know it, you're away. So is it just audiobooks, or is the app going to work with radio or podcasts or music or other kinds of audio?
It will work with any type of audio, provided it is played through the iPhone. We even used it, I was in the developer's offices, and we linked it to the Apple television, and it worked on it as well. But as I say, provided that it's through the iPhone. You can also do it through your smart speaker, but again, provided that you're playing it through the smart speaker from your iPhone.
Right, so it's any app where play controls are present on the Apple Watch. So is the Apple Watch a requirement then?
Yes. At the moment, as I say, we have a version in iOS, which is Apple, but we will bring out an Android version so that it'll work with Samsung and the other technologies. But originally we thought we'd get it up and operating and running with Apple, and then we'd bring out the other version in due course.
So you might be aware that obviously amongst the blind community, you know, audiobooks are massively popular. I mean, they've gone, you know, sort of mainstream, it feels to me, in the last, you know, 20 years or so. More and more people listening to audiobooks, you know, around the house or while driving. Let's hope nobody's falling asleep while doing that. But certainly, you know, blind people, we've been listening to audiobooks for, well, probably 80 years plus. How aware were you of blind and partially sighted people in the development of this project?
When I recognised the problem, I recalled that my father, who was registered blind, had also complained of the same issue and frustration when he was listening to audio playback. Now, unfortunately, my father passed about 20 years ago, so the technology that he was using at that time was obviously very different. I think he used a Daisy audio player or tape player, which obviously the tapes were posted out to him by RNIB. And he complained of exactly the same issue. So I knew that I wasn't the only one who had the problem. As I say, I knew that audio playback and falling asleep had been an issue, as I say, for my father.
And is it just the audio from a media app? So just like Audible or maybe even the RNIB talking books that you can get through the Easy Reader app or a podcast? It wouldn't silence any, you know, incoming calls or other alerts that you might have on your device?
No, it's purely the audio playback that you're playing when you activate the app.
Right. And if you did wake up and you wanted to keep listening, presumably you would just then go back into your media player and just hit play again.
That's it. Exactly. You might want to rewind a little bit because you maybe weren't concentrating just as you fell asleep. But that's exactly what you do.
And have you done any testing with blind and partially sighted people? Have you had any feedback from this community around the accessibility, how well it works with voiceover, etc.?
Yes, the onloading is obviously very important, that it's compliant with VoiceOver, that it all works efficiently. And I've been assured by the developer, again, that it is compliant. I've been in discussion with RNIB for quite a long time, and they've had access to the test versions. And the app is available now in the App Store. And it's free to use for 7 days. So anybody who wants to test it is very, very welcome to do so. Download it, test it for the 7 days, and hopefully then subscribe to buy it for $4.99 per annum.
Thinking further ahead, Gary, are you still going to continue as a chartered surveyor, or are you kind of interested in this whole issue around sleep?
Dave, I absolutely adore being a chartered surveyor. Every day is different. You've different challenges, different successes. I get a real buzz out of it. Now, with regard to the app, in a similar way, I'm getting some great fun out of that as well. And seeing something produced from an idea suddenly coming through to something that you actually have succeeded in developing, I've got to say, really does give me a buzz.
Is this something you think others might try to replicate? When I was looking for the app on the App Store, there are quite a lot of sleep apps out there. I wondered whether you know, this is a kind of feature that maybe Audible or somebody might eventually build in. Would that be a win for you, or do you think there's something to be said for having a standalone app that's going to cover all audio apps?
Well, I think it would make an awful lot of sense for it to be available on the likes of Audible along with Sleep Timer. Certainly, I think it's a much better solution than Sleep Timer, which I don't like using. Well, we'll wait and see. Certainly, if Audible want to talk to me, I'd be very happy to hear from them.
Let's hope so. Well, Gary, thank you so much. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us here on RNIB Tech Talk. If people try Sleep When I Sleep in the Apple App Store, feedback, is that best given as a review on the app, or can people contact you directly?
They can come back to us directly through the website, www.sleepwhenisleep.com. Or they can give the feedback through the app. There is a facility to do so.
Fantastic. Gary McDowell from Sleep When I Sleep, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've received an email from Nick Stone, who's experienced some changes to his home phone setup. And essentially, Nick is telling us that his landline service now is over his internet connection, is my understanding. So, Callum, you've got a bit of previous with phones. So what does that actually mean? So you've still got a regular telephone, right?
Yeah, so this is a new thing that's coming from BT because they're trying to do away with the copper, you know, the traditional copper phone lines. So, yeah, you've still got a telephone. It still works the same way. The only difference is instead of going through a copper phone line, this is now going through your internet connection. So your phone will basically plug into your broadband hub, and then the calls will work through your internet connection.
So Nick is asking for an accessible handset, essentially, and he says that the engineer wasn't able to recommend one, and as a bit of a stopgap, they've diverted calls to his iPhone. Is that something that you're aware of?
I suppose that is a benefit of the new digital voice service. You can be a bit more flexible, you know, in terms of being able to redirect calls. I do know that I looked a few years ago for a talking handset, and I mean fully talking, you know, so read out the menus, read out the phone book. And I know that was a nightmare to find. And I think just because the market's changed, things are going to more towards smartphones. I guess it depends what you mean by accessible. I mean, there's a lot of handsets out there, and I don't know of any specific models, but there's a lot of handsets out there that have still got physical buttons, you know, tactile buttons, and, you know, they've got a voicemail feature, they've got, like, internal call functions and things like that, and they can all be accessed by tactile buttons. They might not speak, but the physical buttons are there. So you might lose out on being able to use the menus and use the address book, but you can overall still answer the phone, dial numbers, things like that.
Yeah, so we have, I think, in our house, Panasonic cordless phones, and they have, as you describe, sort of tactile rubbery buttons. There's a dot on the 5. You know, they sort of helpfully make little bleeps as you press the button. I'm able to dial calls on there. I'm obviously able to, you know, receive calls, put people on hold, use the answer phone. But there is a little screen. It's not a touch screen, but I've no idea what's displayed on the screen. So I can't see, you know, the number of the incoming call before I answer it or anything like that. RNIB has some fixed line phones available through the shop, rnib.org.uk/shop. And some of those phones have large buttons and large numbers. So obviously that's going to help, you know, perhaps somebody with low vision. But if anybody makes a talking fixed line phone that will speak everything that's shown on the screen, we'd like to hear about it, I think, Callum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this one isn't talking as such, but I do know that BT have got a handset with Alexa enabled, but I don't know much about it. But obviously I do work for BT, so I'm more than happy to ask around. I can ask a few colleagues. I'm sure there's some colleagues who will know about it. So we can try and get more information on that as well.
So, Nick, we are going to look into this for you. Watch this space. Callum, you've got yourself the job. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We return now to our interview with Colin Shales from our Technology for Life team, where Colin turns his attention from working in the assistive technology industry, supporting a specific product, to supporting a whole range of products. You said that you came from the assistive technology industry. You were in a testing role there at Dolphin Computer Access, and you began working with us here at RNIB just a few months ago. What was that like, that transition from being focused on a single product to suddenly, you know, offering support for a whole world of products?
Yeah, exactly the point I was going to start with. It was quite difficult, actually. First of all, the move from something that I did, you know, very well, or can, you know, believe that I did very well anyway, with the software testing and helping out closely with the support team to make sure the customer got a good experience with those particular products. But opening up to a world of, you know, infinite technology products, essentially, where you don't know what you're going to be able, what you're going to support from day to day. And that was the intrigue and challenge for me, and what excited me initially about moving on to that kind of broader arena was to exactly to do that, to support people with visual impairments more directly, but also with pieces of technology that I have an actual interest in as well, like smartphone devices with accessibility, for example. So it was quite scary, I would say, to begin with. And I was always told when I went into the role that the job would be very demanding, but also very rewarding. And I can definitely agree with that. That's how it feels at the moment.
So what skills and resources do you draw on? You mentioned there that you just don't know what the next question's going to be. And so, you know, I phone up and I tell you, I don't know, maybe I want to use a Raspberry Pi, for example. How would you sort of help me in that situation?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. So none of us on the Technology for Life team necessarily know everything about everything, but what we do have is each other. We've got an amazing team with lots of different areas of resources and knowledge and experience to draw upon, and obviously a world of information on the internet as well. So if we don't know the answer to these questions personally, we will research them. It's completely acceptable to say to the customer, look, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to your query at the moment and to what you would like to know, but what we will do is we'll go away and we'll have a look, we'll investigate that, or speak to another team member, find out, draw on those experiences and information, and then get the customer the right answer or solution to their query. So it can be an ongoing process. A lot of the time it can be they need help with accessibility on a smart device, and that's absolutely fine. I'm quite well versed in the iPhone area, at least, and can usually support those cases. But in your example with the Raspberry Pi, it definitely needs some research initially. Yeah.
Okay, and let's sort of talk about some of the most common questions that you receive. You mentioned smart devices. Is that tends to be the big one that people contact you about?
Yes, definitely. Definitely in the top three for my experience would either be Android accessibility or Apple accessibility, whether that's a tablet or a phone. We usually get a lot of cases where they simply want, you know, the sight's decreasing and they want to be able to use some of these accessibility features on the devices. And that can either be magnification or screen accommodations to make the screen clearer. Or occasionally it gets to that point where the visuals aren't quite enough and we need to go to screen reading. So the talkback feature on Android and the voiceover feature on the Apple iPhone or the iPad is where we tend to go to next after that.
Do you think we sometimes forget about some of those screen accommodations? There's a lot of talk, obviously, about voiceover, the screen reader on iDevices and talkback on Android. And of course, you can magnify text and icons and images on screen. But, you know, doing things like changing colour and contrast and those things can make a massive difference, can't they?
You're absolutely right. And sometimes it's a bit overkill maybe to suggest to a customer to go straight away to speech, like the voiceover, because it's just a foreign thing to them. It's not something that a lot of people are accustomed to immediately. So it's always good to explore the customer's specific requirements and to really engage with them and find out, you know, how much usable sight does the customer have, and would a screen accommodation like a screen filter or simply making text bolder be the initial step? Because in a lot of cases that can be enough. And then if it needs to move on to the zoom feature for magnification or the screen reading, then that's something we can take them through with like a digital skills one-to-one session, and it may be over a few sessions.
And you don't have to be one or the other. I know that the way you use your device, you take a kind of a hybrid approach of you're using some visual cues, you're using some audio cues, so you can kind of mix and match.
That's right. You don't have to be completely non-sighted, as it were, to use screen reader. I'm registered blind myself, but I have a level of usable sight. And as you say, I have visual cues. I know where I'm looking on the screen, if not exactly what I'm looking at. Text for me, obviously, I can't read without a screen reader, without the voiceover feature. But I can kind of take those visual cues, and then I'm in the right area, I'm in the right control perhaps, and then the screen reader does the rest. So it kind of just gives me that extra confidence in knowing where I am on the display and what's being fed back to me.
Right, and you would favour a device with a larger screen because you're clearly getting the benefit from that when it comes to, you know, videos and photographs and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I do consume a lot of content. I probably consume more content than create content on Apple devices, but yes, I use an iPad for kind of media consumption, whether it be, you know, your Netflix or your Apple TV or things like that. Certainly the web browser experience is slightly better on the iPad, just because you can get that layout, that visual layout of the web page, even if you can't read the content on it. And it just helps you, gives more area for you to point at and to kind of experience those kind of main elements on the page. So yes, I do favour a larger screen, yeah.
So away from smartphones and tablets, what other questions come up quite frequently in terms of things that people want to know about?
Sure. Definitely the RNIB reading services, I would say. The talking book skill on Alexa and, kind of how to register for talking books and get connected with your devices on there. And that leads on to the use of the Dolphin Easy Reader as well, which is a really good way to read your talking books on a device, whether that be Android or Apple. So that definitely comes up quite a lot.
Well, hopefully here on RNIB Tech Talk, we can help with that a little bit and maybe, you know, look to record a demonstration of getting connected with reading services so that you can download and access books. Is there anything else, Colin, other than reading?
So TV accessibility comes up quite a bit, I'd say, just because it's a less of a known kind of area. I mean, TV accessibility has been around for a few years now, but I think with the increase in technology on those TVs, especially Samsung and the likes of LG, the way in which the screen reading works on the TVs is increasing, and a lot more people are hearing about it now and they want to know more about it. So that would come up, maybe not in the top three, but that certainly comes up quite a bit, I would say. And it's something that it's quite good to inform people about.
That's great, Colin. Lovely to have you on Tech Talk, and a very warm welcome again to RNIB. And we hope that you will visit with us often, and it'd be good to know what people are asking about, the questions and the answers. How do people get in touch if someone's out there listening to this thinking, well, actually, I have got a thingy-majig that I need some assistance with? How should we contact the Technology for Life team?
Absolutely. And there's a couple of three ways that a customer can do that. Or anyone indeed, in fact. Firstly, I'd say if you want kind of general information on technology and you just want to kind of peruse what's available and how to get engaged with technology, you can actually check our resource hub, Technology Resource Hub, on the RNIB website. The best way to get to that, I found, is to go to the RNIB homepage, it's rnib.org.uk, and then select find the Technology for Life link. And in there, there's our Technology Hub, where you can explore lots of devices and how to get engaged with those. If you want to contact us directly, you can do. Our main number for the helpline is 0303 123 9999, and you can also contact us on email by tfl@rnib.org.uk.
Colin Shales from RNIB's Technology for Life team, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
That's it for this time here at RNIB Tech Talk. Thank you so much for listening, and do tune in next time for that Ring doorbell review from Callum. And also, we'll be speaking with the one and only David Woodbridge from Vision Australia. That's next time here on RNIB Tech Talk. My thanks, of course, to our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And Tasneem Arshad, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Bye for now.
And from myself, Dave Williams, until next time, bye for now.